going that way. She's talking about very oppressive things. But the difficulties in meditation are real. So although we call this a virtual retreat, our experience is very real. It's in real time with a real body and a real mind and real conditions. And one of the problems that the Buddha points out that I think is very important is the problem of resistance, that we could call vibhava tanha, if you take the Pali, the kind of craving or desire not to have, to get rid of, to repress, to deny, to disassociate, all the different words that we might have in modern language. And this sense of resistance is quite often strong in people who are very, very good-hearted because of our idealism and what we want to be. We want to be good folk who live a good life and don't harm others. And then when seemingly harmful impulses come in or negativities come in, then we quite often resist them through self-disparagement, through self-criticism, through self-judgment, all these kinds of mind states, and then it all gets very, very complex. So what I was suggesting last night was, if you can tune in to goodness in some way, tune into space, tune into, I was using the word affection or metta bhavana, but I really, really like this word affection right now. If I can tune into that as a way of considering life, as a way of interacting with life, not just as a way of meditation. If I can tune into that, then as negativities arise in consciousness, I can perhaps approach them with a sense of space and affection, actually, and rather than resistance. So vibhava tanha, classically in the Pali, is the cause of suffering is one of the types of craving, and one of the types of craving is described as this vibhava tanha, the not wanting part of our minds. And that's different than hatred or aversion or that. It's kind of deeper than that. So when habits of aversion come up into mind, there's nothing really wrong with that. You know, it's just conditioned. But the resistance to that, there's a kind of, what is it? It's a kind of fear of that overtaking you or not wanting that, those different ways of looking at it. Then if you understand yourself in that way, that the manifestation of aversion or whatever, the coming up into the mind is not wrong, it's just habit. It's just habit that's coming into consciousness. And you take a larger perspective on it. And that's why like considerations of space and openness, and it all belongs, as Lompa Sumedho would say, are ways of actually allowing that to be as it is, and then it's not a problem. It goes away from the mind. But if you don't have a way of sort of tuning into the non-resistance the possibility of non-resistance, say, then of course there is always this fight and this struggle to be good and to get rid of the bad. But that's not really, I think, what Buddhist meditation is about. On a moral level, yes, we restrain ourselves from harming others and harming ourselves. So there is restraint in body and speech. But what the mind produces in terms of habit can be quite negative, but it's not wrong. It's not really your essential nature. It's just the way the mind has been conditioned. So it's not wrong for a tree to get knocked down by lightning. It's just the way nature operates. So the awareness or witnessing of this movement takes you to something which is beyond the natural phenomena. But the natural phenomena which bring your mind to a sense of ease is very helpful. So the monks were, you know, as a sangha, we were encouraged to live at the edge of the village or in the forest rather than in the middle of the town, because that's helpful. But it's not liberating. Yeah? The helpfulness is not liberating if it's not seen as something like when I look at the sky here and the blueness of the sky, that's very spacious for me. very uplifting and very beautiful. So it creates a really wholesome effect. But if then I go into a different environment and I don't have access to that, and then I suffer because I don't have that, then of course I'm attached to the beauty. But if I then see that the beauty of the blue sky and the wonder of nature is something that I'm able to appreciate and know, and then I go to that knowing rather than the object. So the object is actually bringing me to a sense of realization that there is in consciousness this deep sensibility, this deep knowing, this silent knowing, which actually I can always access. It doesn't really depend on the blue sky, because it's about my mind. It's about my consciousness, not about the blue sky. So in meditation, what I suggest is, can you tune in to the sense of space, the sense of silence, the sense of metta or affection or goodness, whatever way you do that? And can you make that goodness something which becomes stronger and stronger? Can you make that attunement stronger and stronger? Which isn't like a willful conquering of things or a willful becoming. Rather, it's a noticing and a sustaining of something wholesome and good. So that's the way I kind of think of these things. But it's not intellectual in that sense. You know, the intellect tries to then portray it afterwards because you need words to express things. So it's much more waiting and tuning in and bringing like sensitivity to silence, that kind of a thing, rather than trying to figure it out. So on this retreat, may I suggest you try not to figure anything out? Give yourself a break, right? So whatever I say, forget about it. and see that in the trusting of awareness, and in the patience and receptivity of awareness, truth is revealed. It's revelatory in that sense. Now, when I say truth is revealed, then you think, oh, I'm going to get some revelation, you know, and my head's going to burst open. Then you have another problem. So whatever language you use, you kind of run into this problem of becoming bhava tanha and getting rid of vibhava tanha. And the awake or aware mind is not becoming anything or trying to get rid of anything. And what I'm hoping to do is sort of persuade all of us, myself included, to come to that middle ground where the movement is not who you are, but you are the silent knowing of that movement, the kind of compassionate knowing which allows that movement. That kind of idea is important to me. So with that in mind, let's do some meditation. So this session goes... Yeah, okay, so let's sit for 45 minutes or so, and then I'll give some more ideas. I'll give some guided meditation. So those chat things, like to know, those chat things that are coming up, how are we going to process those?
I can just copy and paste them and then print them out.
Yeah, okay, and then I'll know later. Thank you. Rightio. Again, how I keep asking these kind of rhetorical questions, but how do you remind yourself when you're meditating about the way things are? So I use sound, as you know. So then by just listening to sound, then presence becomes very obvious. And the noticing within the sound is also the silence. the silence of knowing. So in this analogy of tuning, tune into that silence of knowing. And then notice that you're not trying to become anything, and you're not resisting anything. Tune into that way of being. Also, you're not consuming anything. You're not absorbed into thought or experience per se. You know experience. So this is the awake mind. Non-becoming, non-resistance. So you could just spend this time of meditation just in that simple mode. Just listening. Or you could localize your attention. Pick up something which is a bit more concrete, I suppose. So let's say if you take the breath, and you localize your attention on breathing. But notice the knowing is still silent. And your engagement with the object of meditation isn't one to attain anything. You simply know the feeling of breathing. And then if you're falling sleepy or something, then you can make that focus even more extreme. So you can breathe deeply. You put more energy into it. But I think the attitude of kindness to begin meditation is very fruitful. So why don't we do that again? So bring your attention to the center of your chest. Feel that rising and falling. Then imagine name someone who is dear to you. And bring that name in at the in-breath. And on the out-breath, may you be well. So now the awareness is in tune with kindness. You're not trying to become a kind person, but you already have that as a possibility. And then, of course, you can refresh that by bringing other people in. Until you really have that note quite clear in consciousness. And then you can let go of the names of people. and just be with the breath with this sort of affectionate sensitivity, a kind regard, and sustain that note for longer periods of time with the breath. So then the breathing becomes a way of collecting and composing the mind. One in-breath, one out-breath, collecting, composing. And the attitude is this sense of kind regard, or metta bhavana. So a few ideas, let's sit quietly with those. So just a few more words on that, and then we go off into our respective places and practice on our own. When I used to teach metta bhavana, I used to use the usual kind of lists that you find. You know, so you go through the people you love, and then the neutral people, and then the people you might be averse to, this sort of listing of people. And way back in Auckland, when Belgrade was being bombed, that horrible war, I was teaching a retreat and teaching this, and I asked two of the practitioners, who are very compassionate women, very, very loving and caring, and one I asked, I said, how's it going? How's the metta bhavana going? She says, oh, I can't do it. I can't cover everyone. So she has a big family, right? With lots of kids and aunties, and so she's trying to cover everyone. So it was like she had to give equal metta to like 100 people, and she couldn't fit them in 45 minutes. No, that's not what we're doing. The other woman was imagining the bombing of was it Belgrade? I think it was Belgrade, right? Anyway, that war, imagining other people suffering, and then trying to send metta to them to heal them. And she was crying. No, that's not what we're doing. So sometimes metta bhavana gets conflated with prayer. So the way it's phrased is, you know, that I'm sending out metta to whoever, which is okay. It's a nice way of thinking. But what I'm suggesting, without rejecting that, is that once we are in tune with the open heart, with affection, with appreciation, with these kinds of things, and then we abide with that attunement, then when we go out of tune, when we're on a different note of self-disparagement or harsh judgments or fearful prospects and so on and so forth, we can return or try to remember that attunement, which isn't prayer, right? And that, certainly, beings have radiance. So I remember, I think Janice was telling me how when she walked near Lompa Cha, she could just feel his metta and his love just coming near him like a vibration. So not to dismiss that energetic possibility of human radiance, huh? But that idea, I am someone praying to someone else, to me doesn't seem what metta bhavana is about. It seems to me it's about cultivating a way of presence and even interchange, right? That is not conflicted by separation, by alienation, which aversion and fear and greed, all those do to us. Whereas the kind of connection of affection or appreciation or compassion, all these things are, to me, the way of going beyond the boundaries of ego and self and all that we suffer from. And so it's not like a sending out, it's a more like, to me, a remembering of something which is not foreign to us at all. You know, it's not foreign, we all know it. You just have to look at a picture of someone that's dear to you and you know that. Hmm? So for me, how can I return to that? In meditation, I can do it quite deliberately, can't I? I can return to that as an exercise. And then that, of course, creates a kind of vibration or knowing or whatever in consciousness, so that when I enter into complexity and all the rest of life, I can see, oh, there's a different note here. It's called fear. Or there's a different note here. It's called criticism. And not that those are right or wrong, but I can then bypass the inner argument. A lot of us suffer from the inner arguments that I should or shouldn't be, right? We kind of, we go to thought a lot. So the suggestion here is you can bypass thought, not through a lobotomy. I'm not suggesting that, but you can bypass that inner argumentation and come to a wholesome place through knowing the mind is the mind, which we would call cittanupassana, the third foundation of mindfulness. You know the mind is the mind, but you also know what is skillful and what is unskillful through training and meditation. And then the complexities of life, we still enter into them, but now we have a way of being with them as a kind of meditative experience, contemplative experience. And so the training in that, or the doing of that, is very, depends on quite a nice environment, doesn't it? A quiet environment like we have, thank goodness for COVID kind of thing, and a private environment where we can work with that and cultivate that, maybe a beautiful environment by having something that is uplifting in that way, and so that we can touch that. Once we touch that, then we can be in more coarse environments or more troublesome environments, but we can perhaps try to remember that, return to that, so that that becomes a more constant thing in our lives. So what happens there is then the tendency towards like negativity and resistance no longer has less and less power. And what has power is the kind of openness of the heart. And this, again, this isn't sentimental. It's really hard work, actually. It's very subtle. But it's interesting. It's very, very interesting. And it's not just this willful attempt to become enlightened, which is a disaster. Take it from me. So it's something interesting and has kind of kindness in it and beauty and pleasantness in it. And how else are we going to sustain this work of inner understanding if there isn't that in us, right? If it's just like me fighting my meditation cushion or my fighting my pain or fighting my defilements or fighting Mara. So there's a lot of that kind of language, which is very masculine language, I would say, right? The kind of the warrior, nah. And I tried that, but it didn't make me very happy. It ruined my knees, among other things. And so maybe that's just where I'm at, because I used to be a very, very willful chap. You can be very determined. You can be very, very determined, but it doesn't have to be harsh. It doesn't have to be self-disparaging. You know, it doesn't have to be all that. It can be a kind of diligence in kindness, a diligence in sensitivity, these kinds of things. So that's sort of where I come from in terms of this kind of metta bhavana. So now I think, so our next coming together on these kind of sessions will be, for me, 2 p.m. my time, correct? So do practice what you like to practice. One thing with we noticed there was some chat messages coming up while I was talking. I'm afraid I don't have the capacity to process that while I'm talking. It's just too difficult, complicated for me. So if you have questions, first and foremost, see if you can answer them through the day. Like as they come up, like really use them as your own inner inquiry. And then at the end of the day, then if you formulate the question really clearly and then write it down and send it to us or whenever you want to, and then we'll try to, if you possibly, we'll print it out for me and I'll try to answer them as they come. But see that quite often inquiry comes from your own questions, and those are usually the best avenues of investigation and then insight for all of us. All right, so we shall see you after lunch or whenever after is for you, wherever you are. Okay? Namaste.